Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 219, entitled Days of Future Past, and that's spelled P-A-S-S-E-D. The program you're about to hear is excerpted largely from the One Step Beyond program of April 2nd of the year 2000, and in turn you're going to hear two excerpts, one of an archive show, the first archive show from May of 1980, and then in turn from a book, and that will all be explained as you listen to the tape excerpt. Now, as you listen to this, pay close attention to the role of the Munich Reinsurance Group in the events that you're about to hear described, because the Munich Reinsurance Group is the main focal point of the early part of the discussion. Once again, this is from the One Step Beyond show of April 2nd of the year 2000. So for archival value, I'm going to play the original archive tape rather than rereading the text. Now, that text in turn comes from a book called All Honorable Men, authored by James Stewart Martin. The book was published in hardcover by Little Brown Books, copyright 1950. So we're going back 50 years in time for the book and 20 years in time for yours truly in the excerpting of this book. You will also hear a very short presentation at the end by Mark Ortiz, my former co-host, the first of two former co-hosts. So we're going to begin again with an excerpt of archive show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, U.S. Industrial Cooperation with Nazi Germany, recorded on May 23rd, 1980. And in turn, you'll hear an excerpting of All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin.
I think in all of the reading that I've done about the industrial cooperation between this country and Hitler's Third Reich, I think maybe the most shocking, certainly, well, I can't say the most outrageous, one of the most astounding things I came across was a method whereby American companies cooperated with American insurance companies cooperated with the Germans in such a way as to provide them with really astounding amounts of intelligence concerning not only U.S. plants, but also U.S. shipping. Remember that the Battle of the North Atlantic was absolutely critical to the eventual success of the Allies. And I'd like to point out before I read this that, of course, this coming weekend is going to be Memorial Day, at which time America pauses to remember its dead from the foreign wars. Bear in mind that during the Battle of the North Atlantic, the losses among Allied merchant seamen were roughly 1 in 3. A third of all seamen sailing that route lost their lives. Keep that in mind as you listen to the following. As James Stewart Martin, in All Honorable Men, as I mentioned, the chief of the Economic Warfare Section of the Department of Justice, as he was preparing to go to Germany in 1945 to work behind the advancing Allied armies in order to begin investigating German war production, he began to reminisce. Martin writes, "On a bleak night in February 1945, I found myself standing with my small party of investigators in the mist at the Washington airport waiting to take off. As I stood in the gloom, observing all the security measures that shrouded our routine departure, the blackout of the field and the plane, the silence, the sudden orders, I remembered our discovery earlier in the war of how easily the secrecy, unquote, of ship sailings had been penetrated by the Germans. In 1940, 41, and 42, ships leaving American seaports had the same security measures to protect their departure. Yet many of their broken hulls and water-soaked cargoes had washed up onto the beaches of New Jersey, Virginia, and the Carolinas, where German submarines had spotted them within sight of shore. In case after case, every man on board had been marked before the captain opened his orders, though they may not have known it. The cargoes they carried were reinsured with Munich. The routine system of placing insurance had put precise information on their sailing date and destination in the hands of the Germans before the ship left port. In the summer of 1941, before there was any economic warfare section, several trust busters discovered that while the American public was looking more and more askance at German business connections, insurance companies doing an international business seemed to have no such doubts about their foreign commitments. Insurers of large risks, such as ships, cargoes, and industrial plants, customarily spread the risk among other companies willing to take fractional shares. The big insurance and reinsurance companies in the United States which handle the largest risks have such treaties on an international basis through arrangements with the Lloyd's Group in England or with the Zurich Group in Switzerland. It had long been the custom of the American companies to place the reinsurance on ships and cargoes with the Zurich Group by cabling information to them so that they could accept responsibility for a share of the American insurer's risk. The information cabled would include the name of the ship, the sailing date, the cargo carried, the destination, and the value of the insured property. One detail that should have raised someone's eyebrow but did not until the government stepped in was the fact that the Zurich Group in turn had a reinsurance treaty with the Munich Reinsurance Pool in Germany. The result was that during 1940 and early 1941, by the time a ship had cleared New York or Baltimore Harbor headed for a European port, the German intelligence service already had the sailing data in hand. When men from the Department of Justice called a conference of insurance representatives, the companies agreed to stop sending such information by cable. But even then, no one realized what an efficient pipeline the Germans had set up. It appeared later that everyone concerned, both government officials and insurance men, assumed that sending the information by mail to Switzerland would be perfectly all right. Nothing was said about stopping completely the transmission of reinsurance information. In the spring of 1942, after we had started to set up the economic warfare section, we found that reinsurance information sheets, or bordereau, B-O-R-D-E-R-A-U-X, were still going to Switzerland by mail. We also discovered that the reinsurance business, far from being confined to ships and cargoes, also covered industrial plants, and more especially those very large new plants being built for war production, the ones with security guards at the gates to see that no unauthorized eyes got inside. In the case of industrial plants, we found that the reinsurance bordereau did not account for the full extent of the leakage. The usual reinsurance treaty on such risks provides that the reinsurance group has the right to demand copies of a full report by the insurance respector. This report includes blueprints of the installation, description of the fire hazards and risks, and inventory of the contents of the buildings room by room. We found that before 1938, the Zurich Group had asked for the full insurance inspector's report in only 5 or 6% of the cases. After 1938, the full report was requested with increasing frequency until a percentage was closer to 90. It had seemed obvious to us that the government ought to stop this transmission of shipping and industrial information through Switzerland to the Reich. Unlike the United States, the German government as early as 1936 had closed off such information about Germany. As soon as the Germans occupied France, Belgium, and Holland in 1940, they put a stop to all such transmissions from those countries. We proposed to have the Attorney General send a letter to each company warning that transmission of marine and industrial plant information of this type came within the scope of the Espionage Act. Issuance of such a letter in the name of the Attorney General, however, required approval by the Solicitor General, Charles Fahey. Mr. Fahey would not take this responsibility without consulting the other interested departments of the government. At first, no one could believe that Americans were handing the German intelligence service information on a silver platter. At one of Mr. Fahey's interdepartmental meetings, Joseph Borken, then of the Antitrust Division, slapped down on the table a stack of insurance inspectors' reports on various prominent buildings. He had purchased these from sources open to anyone in the insurance business without any special security clearance. For 55 cents, he had the plans of the White House showing the location of the fire extinguishers and other protective apparatus. For 75 cents, he had the plans of a large new magnesium plant. One of the blueprints had an arrow pointing at a valve with the legend, "Under no circumstances must this valve be closed while the plant is in operation, as an explosion would result."
Well, in view of the Memorial Day weekend, I think it also bears saying that it's a tribute to the dedication and ability of American fighting men that we were able to win the war at all.
That, again, excerpted from Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, U.S. Industrial Cooperation with Nazi Germany. That last voice that you heard there was my former co-host at the time, Mark Ortiz. And in turn, you heard a book excerpted that is called... All Honorable Men, authored by James Stewart Martin, published in hardcover by Little Brown, 1950. Now, the key element in that discussion is the Munich Reinsurance Group. That is the Munich, obviously, reinsurance company that had the working agreement with the Zurich Reinsurance Group that provided intelligence on U.S. ship sailings and Allied ship sailings, well, U.S. ship sailings, as soon as the ships left port, and that cost a great many U.S. merchant seamen their lives. It was an enormously costly struggle, the battle for the Atlantic, and the Munich Reinsurance Group played a key part in that battle. I mention this because, as the expression has it, everything old is new again. We're going to turn now to the San Francisco Examiner of Wednesday, March 29th. of the year 2000, and the Munich Reinsurance Group is the focal point of a legal investigation by the Attorney General, or actually the California Insurance Commission, and it is the focal point of litigation. This article is entitled State Wants World War II Era Insurance Policies, subtitled Munich Company Accused of Having Ties to Nazis and, quote, hiding out, unquote, in Europe. It's by Peter Hartlaub of the Examiner staff, and it reads as follows. The largest reinsurance company in the world once had strong ties with Adolf Hitler and is now hiding out, unquote, overseas to avoid an investigation of Holocaust-era insurance claims, state officials contend. Note that the Munich Reinsurance Group is now the largest reinsurance company in the world, certainly providing some very, very interesting information to not only the underground Reich, but also the German government and German intelligence. Continuing. The allegations by the California Insurance Commission against Munich Reinsurance Company surfaced this month in a legal petition that has become the center of a court battle in San Francisco. Insurance Commissioner Chuck Quackenbush, who has been investigating Holocaust-era insurance claims since 1998, wants a judge to order Munich Reinsurance to turn over insurance policies that it and its affiliates issued from 1920 to 1945. Munich Reinsurance has filed its own detailed legal complaint, claiming Quackenbush doesn't have the right to sue the German corporation. The dispute between Quackenbush and Munich Reinsurance has been going on for more than a year, but the telephone book-sized petition filed on March 20th represents the first time the state has asked a judge to act as an enforcer. A hearing on the petition is scheduled for April 11th in San Francisco's Superior Court. The complaint alleges that Munich Reinsurance had close ties to the Nazi regime, claiming a former president for the company was also an economics minister for Hitler. Quote, Munich RE was a Nazi collaborator, and it and its affiliates then victimized and are still victimizing these persons today, many of whom are residents of this state, unquote, the petition contends. Munich Reinsurance lawyer Martin Chekhov called those allegations, quote, irrelevant, unquote, to the case, and in a letter accused Quackenbush of seeking publicity. In court papers, Chekhov claims Munich Reinsurance had a U.S. branch that started doing business in California in 1959, but stopped 3 years ago when its license ran out. Quote, Munich RE is a reinsurer organized under the laws of Germany with its headquarters in Munich, Germany. It maintains no office employees or license to do business in California, unquote, Chekhov said in a court declaration. Chekhov added, quote, a subpoena issued under the law of this state cannot compel a person located in a foreign country to attend a deposition in California, unquote. The commissioner is investigating whether any Holocaust survivors or their heirs in California are entitled to long dormant policies which were not honored by occupying Nazi forces. Some insurers have tried to settle the claims, while others have not cooperated with the investigation. Insurance Commission spokesman Ryan Staley said Munich Reinsurance has been, quote, seriously uncooperative, unquote. Again quoting, they just have been on the sidelines every step of the way, unquote, Staley said. Munich Reinsurance points out in court papers that it turned over information last year after company officials entered into a stipulation with Quackenbush. Quackenbush claims the company didn't turn over enough. As a reinsurance company, Munich insures more than 5,000 other insurance companies, according to its website. The petition claims the company is the single largest reinsurer in the world, although Munich Reinsurance claims only to be one of the largest. Lawyers for the Insurance Commission accuse Munich Reinsurance of, quote, hiding out in Munich, unquote, after doing business in California for 40 years. And note, as pointed out here, note the absurdity of Munich RE's legal arguments. Quote, it would be an absurdity to suggest that a California corporation of any kind could escape its liabilities to California regulators simply by moving out of the state, the petition states. The petition contends Munich Reinsurance's ties to Hitler were stronger in the Holocaust when it was one of the two largest reinsurers in the world. According to the court papers, Kurt Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-T-T, was Hitler's economics minister from 1933 to 1934, before retiring to become president of Munich Reinsurance. The petition contends that his Nazi allegiances remain strong, Quote, in August 1936, Schmidt caused Munich RE to sponsor a hunting outing for high Nazi officials, including SS Chief Heinrich Himmler, at Schmidt's lodge, unquote, the petition states. Chekhov said he is filing a response to the petition, which will call the Nazi collaborator accusations irrelevant, unquote. In a letter to the Department of Insurance, he criticizes Quackenbush for sending out a press release about Munich reinsurance to the media earlier this month. Quote, it has not escaped the attention of my clients that while they have dedicated themselves to a process of negotiation and cooperation, the Department of Insurance Commissioner has used every opportunity to disparage and attempt to intimidate respondents in the public media, Chekhov wrote. Even if a judge grants the Department of Insurance Commissioner its request, it may be difficult for the department to compel records from Munich Reinsurance. Quackenbush has threatened to strip the license of European companies that do not cooperate with his investigation. But Munich Reinsurance doesn't have a license in California anymore. Quote, obviously, we can't remove their certificate because they have none, Staley said. Staley said a court order could include fines against Munich Reinsurance's affiliates, which still operate in the United States. I would point out that it may be that either veterans of and or relatives of those who were on ships that were torpedoed in the Atlantic during World War II might have reason to engage in class action litigation against Munich Reinsurance. I don't know the fine legal points of this, but again, either veterans of and or relatives of U.S. merchant seamen who were torpedoed in the North Atlantic during World War II might very well have reason to engage in class action litigation against Munich Reinsurance. Might want to consult counsel.
That again was excerpted from the One Step Beyond program of April 2nd of the year 2000. Now, with regard to the Munich Reinsurance Group, that institution was one of the many German companies that participated in the Bormann Flight Capital Organization and the Bormann Flight Capital Program, about which we've spoken so many times. Listeners who are new to this concept, and there will be many, should check with Spitfire and check the references in the very extensive body of tapes available from Spitfire. About the Munich Reinsurance Group and its association with the Bormann Program, the Bormann Organization, and related elements, we're going to reference the definitive work on the Bormann Group, that entitled Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, and copyright 1981. Paul Manning was part of the CBS News team that covered World War II in Europe, along with Edward R. Murrow. He flew both as a gunner in a B-17 and in a B-29 to cover the air wars in Europe and Japan, respectively, and broadcast the surrenders of both Japan and Germany to the American people on the CBS radio network, and then investigated the Bormann Flight Capital Program. Of the Bormann Flight Capital Program and its relocation of capital to Argentina, and the role in that of, among other companies, the Munich Reinsurance Group, we read, There was also the important German insurance firm of El Phoenix Sudamericano Sia de Reasurgios S.A., an affiliate of the Munich Reinsurance Company. That word that I couldn't pronounce is R-E-A-S-E-G-U-R-O-S. One more time. There was also the important German insurance firm of El Phoenix Sudamericano Sia de Reaseguros S.A., an affiliate of the Munich Reinsurance Company. All South American big business came to depend on El Phoenix as the principal reinsurers of commerce and industry in Latin America. Now we're going to go back to the April 2nd, 2000 One Step Beyond program, from which the rest of this program is excerpted.
The whole issue of Third Reich connected insurance companies is anything but irrelevant here in California, as indicated in the last paragraph of that article. And note the following from the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, December 3rd of 1999. This is an article by George Raine, R-A-I-N-E, of the Examiner, headlined, World War II Policies List Not in State. Subtitled, Fireman's Fund Tells State That Info is Held by German Owners. Reads in part as follows. California Department of Insurance officials examining the progress of insurance industry compliance with a Holocaust-era disclosure law said they were dissatisfied with testimony from lawyers for Novato-based Fireman's Fund. The lawyers, responding to a subpoena, said Thursday they could not provide the kind of detail officials sought,
nor did they know whether Fireman Fund's parent, Allianz of Germany, will fully comply with terms of the California Holocaust Registry law. When pointedly asked if Allianz will satisfy the essence of the California law by filing by April 6th a list of insurance policies issued between 1920 and 1945, Senior Vice President and General Counsel of Fireman's Fund said, quote, "I do not have the answer to that question," unquote. Remains to be seen. What we're going to do is to jump from the past to the future, in a sense. And what we're going to do now is to listen to a short section of a lecture that I gave in January of the year 1995, specifically January 21st of 1995. This is a lecture entitled Technology, Theocracy, and the Thousand-Year Reich. It deals with a fairly complex array of information. And I want to note that this does concern some prognostications about the future. This, again, is from January of 1995, and it was given at Deep River Bookstore in Santa Monica. We're going to listen to a section of the tape, and then we're going to jump to the present.
I also think that the dictates of the corporate state may very well result in the replacement of workers with other things to perform tasks specifically. Now, this is something that has actually been discussed, and in fact, there was a lot of debate in the mid-1980s, and that is using genetic engineering to create new species. In fact, in 1985, there was a hot exchange between a number of scientists and the Vatican. There were proposals being floated to take some human genes and to splice them into primates so that you would create a new species, not as intelligent as human beings, perhaps, but far more intelligent than orangutans, chimpanzees, what have you, in order to perform tasks of menial labor. Now, these creatures would not have human rights because they would not, in fact, be human. So if you have a problem where you have to get a bunch of people to schlep a bunch of minerals up out of a mountainside, and it's very costly to provide for the safety of the workers, get a bunch of genetically engineered creatures who could schlep the minerals out of the mountainside, and you wouldn't have to worry about them getting sick and dying because they wouldn't be human. Also, the development of robotics, I think, at some point in the future will be used to gradually replace the worker. I think that we may ultimately, and this might be millennia in the future, assuming we survive, I think that the imperfections of human beings, and human beings are highly imperfect, may ultimately lead to the creation of artificial intelligences. It would not surprise me if we survive long enough that at some point in the future we might create an artificial intelligence, a machine which would actually represent something of a life form, in that it would be self-conscious and intelligent enough to regard itself as separate from its actual creators. It would not surprise me if these machines eventually decided to turn on their creators. And we're talking about something that might take place thousands of years in the future and decide that basically the machines should supplant people altogether because people are sloppy. You know, they have cells, they get sick, they have emotions, they have feelings. And however much we've tried to get them to sit on the tack, it just doesn't work. However, a machine can sit on the tack because it doesn't have any feelings. You just don't put any circuitry in that part of its construction. It would not surprise me if we eventually, at some point in the future, built machines which replaced us quite consciously, saying that people are stupid. You know, they're stupid, they're weak, they have emotions. They are inefficient, and they are not really in keeping with the dictates of the corporate state. If we created a machine at some point in the future, maybe 10,000 years or 20,000 years from now, which simply put us out of existence because we are not efficient.
That is some rumination concerning the future, and I certainly hope I'm wrong, but that remains to be seen. That, again, excerpted from a lecture entitled The Future, Technology, Theocracy, and the Thousand-Year Reich, given on January 21st of the year 1995, and that was given at Deep River Bookstore in Santa Monica. We're going to jump once again to the present, and we're going to turn to an article from the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, March 13th. Of the year 2000. This is an article by Joel Garreau, G-A-R-R-E-A-U, of the Washington Post, headlined, "Scientist is Fearful of Computer Mutiny," subtitled, "Sun Micro Co-Founder Says Replicating Robots Could Replace Humans." The article reads in part as follows. A respected creator of the information age has written an extraordinary critique of accelerating technological change in which he suggests that new technologies could cause something like extinction, unquote, of humankind within the next two generations. The alarming prediction, intended to be provocative, is striking because it comes not from a critic of technology, but rather from a man who invented much of it, Bill Joy, J-O-Y, chief scientist and co-founder of Sun Microsystems Incorporated, the leading web technology manufacturer. Joy was an original co-chairman of a presidential commission on the future of information technology. His warning, he said in a telephone interview, is meant to be reminiscent of Albert Einstein's famous 1939 letter to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, alerting him to the possibility of an atomic bomb. In a 24-page article in the Wired magazine that will appear on the web tomorrow, Joy says he finds himself essentially agreeing, to his horror, with a core argument of the Unabomber, Theodore Kaczynski, that advanced technology poses a threat to the human species. By the way, I would not should not be misinterpreted as in any way endorsing Theodore Kaczynski. I think an intelligent approach to some of this is very much in order. But note here Bill Joy's prediction, quote, or prognostication, quote, I have always believed that making software more reliable, given its many uses, will make the world a safer and better place, unquote, Joy wrote in the article which he worked on for 6 months. Again quoting, if I were to come to believe the opposite, then I would be morally obligated to stop this work. I can now imagine that such a day may come, unquote. Joy enjoys a level-headed reputation in the industry. Quote, nobody is more phlegmatic than Bill, said Stuart Brand, an internet pioneer. He is the adult in the room, unquote. Joy is disturbed by a suite of advances. He views as credible the prediction that by 2030, computers will be a million times more powerful than they are today. He respects the possibility that robots may exceed humans in intelligence while being able to replicate themselves. He points to nanotechnology, the emerging science that attempts to create any desired object on an atom-by-atom basis, and agrees that it has the potential to allow inexpensive production of smart machines so small they could fit inside a blood vessel. Genetic technology, meanwhile, is inexorably generating the power to create new forms of life that could reproduce. What deeply worries him is that these technologies collectively create the ability to unleash self-replicating, mutating, mechanical, or biological plagues. Again quoting, these would be a replication attack in the physical world, unquote, comparable to the replication attack in the virtual world that recently caused the shutdowns of major commercial websites. Quote, if you can let something loose that can make more copies of itself, unquote, Joy said in a telephone interview, again quoting, it is very difficult to recall. It is as easy as eradicating all the mosquitoes. They are everywhere and make more of themselves. If attacked, they mutate and become immune. That creates the possibility of empowering individuals for extreme evil. If we don't do anything, the risk is very high of one crazy person doing something very bad. Unquote.
That again was excerpted from the One Step Beyond program of April 2nd of the year 2000. And I certainly hope that Mr. Joy is wrong, and I hope that I'm wrong, but we will see. This concludes For the Record program number 219, Days of Future Past.